a friend of mine, I think I can say, but he is the CEO of the Alzheimer's Association. Come on up, Richard, for the chapter, the Houston chapter in the Southeast region of Texas. His undergrad degree is from the University of Texas. He has a master's degree also in biochemistry and nutrition from Virginia Tech. He is a Hokie and a Longhorn, both, and had 20 years in experience, over 20 years experience in the healthcare administration industry and area before moving over to the Alzheimer's Association. And I'm going to talk to him just a little bit about what that move looked like and then turn it over to him to talk a little bit about healthy aging and things of that sort. And I'm sure we're going to have lots of time for questions too. In fact, we talked a little bit. We can kind of make this more of a dialogue. And if y'all have a question as he speaks, just feel free to raise your hand. And sometimes that makes it even more lively about and responsive to what is going on in your mind and in your lives a little bit too. But Richard, again, thanks for being here today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And let me kind of start out with a few questions, sort of interview style, before I turn it over to you. But kind of just tell us a little bit about the Alzheimer's Association in general and what you do day to day, what the association does day to day in this area in particular.
Sure. So thank you all for letting me come and visit with you today. I appreciate it. I do have to tell you one funny thing about, I'm a graduate of University of Texas at Austin, and as you know, the mascot is a steer. And then I went to Virginia Tech, and the mascot there is a Hokie, which is a castrated turkey. So my friends really wondered why I was selecting schools that has had castrated mascots. So
it's kind of going down.
Yeah, downhill. I mean, really, from a steer to a turkey. Yeah.
I did not know that. I didn't even know what a Hokie was.
Yeah, and in fact, they had a terrible football team, unlike UT. They had a terrible football team at Virginia Tech. And so they were so proud when they actually scored that they had speakers all over campus that gobbled if they had a touchdown. And it was rare that you ever heard the gobble.
Yeah.
So
it
was kind of like, oh, okay.
Well, it's a good school.
Yeah.
It's an outstanding
good school. Good school. So Alzheimer's Association, we're the largest health organization in the world dealing with Alzheimer's and other dementias. And internationally as well as nationally, our role is to fund research. So we lead the way in Alzheimer's research. Locally, we fund more than $10 million in Alzheimer's research at every major academic institution in our region. And then we support families affected by Alzheimer's disease through all kinds of information, resources. We run program support groups, provide educational programs. We're involved with public policy and advocacy to make sure that the legislation that exists supports families affected, that, for example, medications are covered by Medicare that families may need, that there's funding for education for health service providers to make sure that they know what they're doing in the area of Alzheimer's and dementia. So very involved across the entire spectrum of Alzheimer's and dementia programming, research, support. Locally, we work with partners across the area to provide services and support. So we work with volunteers, we work with other service organizations to make sure that they have the resources they need to support their own communities. So we're really very community focused in that we work with whatever communities already exist.
And I know that, I guess I saw you last Thursday, was it Thursday? Richard and I are both on the advisory board for Amazing Place of Houston. And that's one example of one of the community organizations that
right.
y'all partner with.
Correct. So we work with organizations that are specifically dementia care providers, as well as organizations and groups that may not focus on dementia. They may just focus on their community and want to be a place that their community members can come to get information or get support, and we want to make sure they know what support looks like. And that they have the resources.
Yeah. Now, I think I may know the answer to this question, but I want you to talk a little bit about it. And I'm not sure exactly what you did in healthcare administration before going over to the Alzheimer's Association, but maybe talk about sort of that transition. What led you into this particular area? And I know that it oftentimes it's very common with people that they get involved in something because they begin to have some real personal. It touches their life in a very personal way. But talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So my background is biochemistry and nutrition. And so I did some things specifically. Well, I ended up in healthcare, which I guess, you know, if you don't know what else to do, you do healthcare. So there I was.
It's always a growth industry.
It's a growth industry. So I was in healthcare administration for many years, first in typical hospital settings, then in a psychiatric hospital setting, and eventually in pharmaceutical organizations. And so I worked with a company that was a distributor of pharmaceuticals and also ran drug trials. And they decided that everyone in senior administration needed to move to St. Louis, and I was not interested in moving to St. Louis, and so I decided I was going to stay in Houston and find something else. And someone I know said, hey, there's this great opportunity with the Alzheimer's Association. And I thought, okay, that sounds interesting. So I interviewed, and about the third interview, the chair of the search committee asked if I had a connection to Alzheimer's disease. And I said, no, I don't. I don't have any connection. They said, that's okay. You don't have to. And so I went home. And then I was at home, and I was thinking about my grandmother, who regularly called me by my father's name, didn't seem to know whether I was her son or her grandson. I thought, huh, that's interesting. No one ever talked about it in my family. It was just the case. We all accepted that sometimes she would call me by my father's name. I said, that kind of seems like it may be some kind of dementia. And then I thought about, so that was my father's mother. And then I thought about my mother's father, who didn't know what season of the year it was, where he was living. He'd been moved by my parents from his home to their home. And he didn't realize that he was no longer in that state. Very disoriented. So I thought, this is very strange. I think I actually do have a connection to Alzheimer's. So I called the chair of the search committee back, and I said, okay, I know this sounds very strange. By the way, it was 9:30 at night. And so I said, I know this may seem very strange, but I think I need to change my answer. And so then I told her the reasons I was changing my answer, which seemed like, I mean, you don't do that at an interview. It's a bad idea. But apparently, they didn't have a lot of options because they ended up hiring me. So I did have an Alzheimer's connection, which was typical. I've been with the Alzheimer's Association 21 years. And 21 years ago, no one said Alzheimer's out loud in public. I mean, it just wasn't talked about. And so, of course, my family was like everyone else's family. That was happening, but we just didn't talk about it. And so that was kind of a typical experience. Now today, and back then, if I went to a party and I wore my name tag that said Alzheimer's Association, it was like the loneliest corner of the room because everybody else was at that corner. Like, we're not associating with him. Now, if I walk into a room and people see that I'm with the Alzheimer's Association, it's like a rock star. Everybody wants to know, okay, what can you tell me? Because we all have that experience. I mean, one in three families in America is affected by Alzheimer's disease. And so when you think one in three families, that's a bunch of people. I don't have to work hard to find people who have the connection. What I have to work hard is to find the people who have the connection while they're still struggling with the problem instead of, I mean, the worst thing I hear is, oh, yes, I wish I would have known about you and your organization. That's a terrible thing. Families shouldn't struggle with this disease by themselves. So I don't want any other families to deal with the way my family dealt with it, which was not to talk about it and not to know where to go for resources.
Yeah. Well, I think the Alzheimer's Association and different groups have been sort of at the forefront of changing that sort of stigmatized way of thinking in the past of where it's just senility and, you know, put grandmother away and we won't talk about it. And the Alzheimer's Association has been, like I said, on the, at the forefront of changing that idea and ability to talk about it and to deal with it. Talk to us a little bit about some statistics about, you mentioned 1 in 3 families is impacted by Alzheimer's. Maybe a few other statistics. I bet you have some of this at just at the tip of your fingers, but about what sort of problem this is. It's not just a problem that's particularized to individual people. It's really a society-wide problem that we're having to deal with.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit.
So I'll just tell you, I'm terrible at statistics. So if I go too deep into it, I'll start lying, and I don't want to do that. But we're talking about more than 6 million Americans currently have Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia. And, I mean, that's a huge number. So just imagine you could take the entire region of Southeast Texas, and you've almost got the number of people who are currently living with Alzheimer's. Sometimes on the freeway, it feels like they're all on our freeway. But I mean, truly, it's a huge number, and there's a huge financial impact that goes along with it. So, you know, when we talk about that 6 million plus Americans who are dealing with Alzheimer's, they've each got at least a couple caregivers, which means we're talking about 18 to 20 million caregivers who they're having to change their lives in order to provide the support for their family member. And so often, you know, it's affecting their workplace, it's affecting their social life, it's affecting their ability to have an income to support themselves and their loved ones. So those are massive impacts. In Texas, so if we come into Texas and talk about it, it's about 450,000. So again, really big numbers. And, of course, those numbers are increasing. In terms of seniors, if we talk about seniors, 2/3 of seniors die with some form of dementia. So, again, big numbers. Now, you know, there are lots of reasons for that, but big numbers, and it means almost all of us are going to be affected one way or another. We used to say that if you live to 85 years old, so it's 1 in 2 seniors over the age of 85. So if you live to 85 years old and you're married, one of you will be a caregiver. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's a shocking concept.
Talk to us a little bit about, like, I think the work that you're doing, and you've been doing this 20 years now, it really is, you know, heroic every day dealing with this. And I'm sure that there's a sense of, you know, meaningfulness in the work, but does sometimes, is it hard to have hope in the work, or how do you deal with that kind of personally and professionally in terms of sort of the tension between this is really meaningful, but it's also really, really hard work to do.
So it is hard work. I think it's meaningful. It's more meaningful than it is hard. I'll just say it that way. And I think one of the challenges, one of the opportunities for us as an organization and for us to communicate to families and to communities is that there's a huge opportunity that is presented through the experience of Alzheimer's and dementia. So I'll tell you, so I told you that 2 of my 4 grandparents had Alzheimer's. And, you know, that there are a few risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. The single biggest risk factor is just age. So at the age of 65, 1 in 9 are at risk of developing Alzheimer's, and then it just keeps increasing every 5 years or so until you get to that really high number at age 85. So we know that we're going to start to know people who are affected by Alzheimer's just by getting older. So, and then, of course, there's a risk associated with having a family history. So that increases your risk. So if you're 65 or older and you have a family history, your risk is greater than someone who's 65 and has no history of Alzheimer's and dementia. So knowing that I have a family history, it's like, okay, probably need to think about this. So then it turned out my mother started developing dementia, and I was her primary caregiver, and so I was dealing with my mother. And My mother had a sister who she was completely estranged from forever. So, I mean, I really didn't know her well. But when I first started at the Alzheimer's Association, so back that 21 years ago, randomly I got a call from this aunt. Like, okay, really? And so she called me and she said, well, I've been talking with my attorney and he's going to be my power of attorney, my medical power of attorney, my executor, but he says I have to have a backup just in case. And she says, I'm thinking that you might be the right person. So I said, she says, you won't ever have to do anything. You just have to have your name on it because he wants a backup.
I've heard that before.
So I thought, okay, you know, that sounds fine. I mean, I was 21 years younger than now and 21 years stupider. And so I said, yeah, okay, fine. I mean, I didn't know this aunt. I didn't really know anything about this, all this stuff she wanted me to do. But I didn't. She said, I don't have to do anything. So I thought, good. So I said, yeah, put me down. So she puts me on the forms and she sends me the legal documents that are done. And I stick them in a drawer. So 12 years later, I get a call from a neighbor who says, your aunt is acting very strangely, and I'm just concerned about her. So, okay, well, I have this document. Let me pull it out and give you the name of the attorney. So I pull it out. I think, I'll just call the attorney and tell him he needs to go check on my aunt, who he's responsible for. So I called the attorney, and he says, I'm retired. I said, well, did that get your name off of the form? Because it doesn't say, while I'm an attorney, it says, you're the... He says, the only way I'll do anything is if you come up, because you're related to her. So I end up having to fly to Pennsylvania to check on my aunt. And while I'm there, all kinds of things happen, and it turns out she definitely has dementia of some sort. And so I'm working with this attorney trying to figure out what we're going to do. And guess what? He has a stroke. And so he has a stroke and ends up in the hospital, not to come out being able to be the executor, the power of attorney, the medical power of attorney. And so my aunt lied to me when she said, you'll never have to do anything, because I ended up being her caregiver for the rest of her life. So I ended up, at one point, I had my mother and my aunt, who did not speak to each other. I had moved them both to Houston, and I had to have them pretend that they didn't know each other because... So it became very personal, is what I'll say. And you know, it became almost... I mean, I found joy in... I mean, I didn't know this woman, but she was funny. And you know, it just... There was... I could have either seen it as a huge burden and terrible, and you can imagine that you could write that story, but that's not the story I wanted to write. I got a lot of individual time with these people, and when they were fully available, it was lovely. And when they weren't, it still ended up being sometimes very interesting. And so that's what I want every family to be able to experience is, you know, there's an opportunity. You'll never have more intimate time with someone than when you're a care provider for them.
Yeah. Well, that's a really beautiful way to kind of frame meaning and hope and that tension and really, you know, living a rich life if you take those opportunities, even though they are difficult to do. Well, what I would love to do now is just kind of turn it over to you to talk a little bit about aging issues and what you want to talk to us about. I know folks will have questions. In fact, I think Cindy already has a question, so maybe we'll tip off with that, and then you can take it where you want it to go.
Okay. Okay, that's a great question. So I don't know if everyone heard the question. How do you know, basically, how do you know the difference between normal aging and something else that would be dementia? So I think Judging from the amount of gray hair in the room, I'm going to say that you all have experienced some aging. And I think with that aging, you probably have experienced some change in your cognitive abilities. Would everybody agree with that? Okay. So that's normal aging. That's cognitive decline. And we've all experienced it in different ways. And I'll just say that if you have grandkids especially, you're reminded of your cognitive decline. You're walking through the Galleria with your grandchild, and somebody walks by and says, "Hey, how are you?" And you chat for a minute, and they walk off. And you say, "I have no idea who that was." And I think we've all had that happen. And if you're with your grandchild who says, "Come on, they live two doors down across the street." Ah, okay. So you wonder, oh my goodness, am I losing it? Because I out of context, I didn't snap. And you're probably not going to snap as often as you did 20 years ago. That's cognitive decline. But the reason that you're not snapping at the same pace that your grandchild is snapping is because your grandchild has a mostly empty brain. I mean, if you think about it, this is like, you know, when you first move into a house, if you can remember back to the last time you moved, and you put all the clothes in the closet, and they were organized. You remember? You actually had, like, all of the shirts together and all of the pants together and all the shoes were on little racks. It was lovely, wasn't it? Yeah, and then you started using that closet and you got really busy and there was a lot of stuff that had to go on, more in that closet than what you thought it could fit. And so there was kind of stuff that ended up hanging off the shelves and on the floor, and it got harder to find the yellow shirt that you were looking for because it wasn't just maybe so organized. Well, that's what aging is like. Your brain is full of all that stuff that's gotten crammed in there over all those years. Well, a kid doesn't have all that. They still have an empty closet. And so for them to remember your neighbor two doors down, they don't have a lot of faces to sort through. You have a lot of faces. So at some point, if you wouldn't have been with your grandchild, you would have gotten home and it would have, oh, that's right, that's my neighbor from two doors down. You would have finally remembered. That's cognitive decline. That's normal aging. That's different than changes that are, so dementia, those are actually, it's a disease state. It's a process that's killing brain cells, and you're not going to ever get back to who the neighbor is. In fact, you may forget that you even ran into the neighbor. So dementia is changing your ability to do normal activities of daily living. It interferes with those activities, which is different than that cognitive decline, which is just, you're going to do it, it's going to be a little slower, you may come back to it later. So, you know, losing your keys, or, you know, you go to the medical center for an appointment and you park in the garage and you forget to take a picture of the car and which floor, which garage, and then you find yourself wandering around like a fool. I have never done that. But so there is a difference, and I mean, if you're concerned, if you have a loved one that you say, like, this is what I did with my mother. So my mother, I was noticing things. I mean, she got lost in her car in the neighborhood that we grew up in, so in Houston. She was at a corner, three blocks from the house where we grew up, five blocks from her current house, and she called me and she said, "I am lost." I said, "Great, tell me what street signs?" And then she told me the street signs. I said, "Mom, you're five blocks from the house." Well, she said, "All right, so tell me which way I should go." It's like, okay, there's probably something going on. So I called and made an appointment for her to go in, and I said, you know, the same way as if you were out of breath constantly, you would make an appointment with the cardiologist to find out what's happening. You'd get a baseline. And so, you know, at some point, if you think, maybe this is not normal, so I maybe should see what my baseline is to compare in the future. So you make an appointment with a neurologist and you get a baseline. So I made an appointment for her, but then every time I tried to tell her that I made the appointment, I think she knew that I was up to something. So she kept avoiding the conversation. And then we were like 5 days out from her appointment, and I still hadn't talked to her. And then my phone rang. I answered it, and it was my mother. "Hi, Mom. What's up?" She said, "You're lucky. I have a good sense of humor." I said, "Really? Why is that?" She said, "Well, imagine the conversation when I got a call from the Alzheimer's Disease and Memory Disorder Center at Baylor calling to confirm my appointment. And I said, I don't remember making one." So anyway, so I would say that if you have a question, it's always a good idea to make an appointment and, you know, go in and have some cognitive testing and just find out if your concerns are justified or not. And either way, you'll have a baseline so that you can compare in the future whether there's really a cognitive change to be concerned about or if this is normal aging.
Yeah, and just having a relationship with a neurologist is really good when you're not in crisis.
Right.
Probably as well, but that's
right.
Great.
Absolutely.
I said I was going to turn it over to you, and I kind of hesitated, but go.
If you have,
this is great.
If you have a question, you can.
I was going to say that we begin to decline cognitively at about age 35. Like it starts, you know, very much earlier than we think, and which made me think about, like, in terms of medications or therapies for Alzheimer's. Is there some work that's going on that would be a therapy that when you're, you know, maybe there's genetic testing, we're going to start giving you some medication when you're 30 years old. Things like that, is that going on? Tell us a little bit about the state of medicine right now.
So, state of medicine. So, first of all, I have to tell you that, let me ask, how many of you are doing something because you have a risk of cardiovascular disease? It should be almost everyone in the room, so just so you know. So if you aren't raising your hand, I would say, have you talked to your cardiologist? But at this point, and because of some amazing studies that were done in Framingham, Massachusetts, going back 70-plus years, we have a lot of understanding about heart disease. And from those studies over the years, we learned that cholesterol is an indicator of potential cardiovascular problems that later could turn into heart attacks. So for most people by the age of 50, they're on some kind of cholesterol-lowering medication. So that's great. So, you know, we've at least postponed, if not completely prevented, heart attacks as a result of people who are managing their cholesterol. And the same if we think about stroke and we talk about hypertension. So that's the goal that we would like to get to with Alzheimer's and dementia, is to say, okay, if we can figure out what are the early indicators of those changes in the brain that ultimately will become Alzheimer's disease, if we can manage those early indicators, maybe we can postpone or prevent Alzheimer's. So there is a lot of work in that area. In fact, there's a medication, you probably have all read about this. So about a year ago, there was a lot of controversy about this drug called Aduhelm, which got approval by the FDA, and then the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid said, we're not paying for that drug because we don't really believe it works. And there were a whole bunch of scientists who said, yeah, we kind of don't think it works either. And so there was enough controversy that the manufacturer of that drug said, yeah, we're going to pull it from the market. They had also priced it at $56,000 a year. So they said, yeah, we're not really going to market this drug. It's just going to be there, but we're not going to market it. But then there are a bunch of other drugs in the same class, which is monoclonal antibodies. So these drugs are designed to go into the brain and clear the protein that's associated with Alzheimer's. So that's amyloid. So there's a sticky protein in the brain that ultimately damages the brain cells. And so we're gonna develop this drug that clears those. with the idea that that will slow or even stop the progression of Alzheimer's. So the second drug came out about 2 months ago, I think. It's called lecanemab. Leqembi is the fun name. Like, really, who comes up with these names? But anyway, so this drug, unlike that first drug, this one, the data is very clear that it works. So this drug really does clear this protein. And in people who start the drug very early in their disease process, it seems to slow the disease. So it doesn't stop it, but it seems to slow it. So that's very hopeful. Well, now there's a group in Houston, at Houston Methodist, and a few other places around the country, that are looking to test this same drug in people who have no symptoms whatsoever. So they're cognitively normal, but they have a couple things. One is they have a genetic risk, so specific genetic risk for Alzheimer's, and they have elevated levels of this protein. So if they have elevated levels of the protein and they have a genetic risk, then they're going to be started on this drug with no symptoms whatsoever to see if they can actually just stop the disease from progressing. So I think that's the goal with medical interventions, is to find that magic disease modifier, in the same way that cholesterol is or lowering high blood pressure is. I will say that for all of you who are on some kind of cardiovascular medication, hopefully you know that even more powerful than those medications is lifestyle change. So what came out of that Framingham study that I mentioned is that lifestyle is more powerful than any medication, and that you can completely stop your risk of cardiovascular disease. Full stop, not slow it down, full stop. So we're doing a similar study. In fact, Houston is one of five sites around the country looking at a lifestyle intervention as a way to prevent Alzheimer's disease. And that's very promising. Obviously, we don't have the results from the study here. This study is based on a study that we funded in Finland that did the similar lifestyle interventions with a bunch of Finns. And, you know, Finnish people are a little different than Americans in many different ways. We have a different gene pool. We eat very different foods. They have socialized medicine. They tend to do things in groups. Americans, you all are kind of counterculture because Americans like to do things by themselves. So for all those reasons, we need to see if it works here. But it's looking at lifestyle. And you know, you might say, well, what lifestyle are we talking about? So we're talking about changes in diet, exercise, cognitive stimulation, social engagement, and then better medical management of chronic conditions like hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes. So those are the lifestyle interventions that we're looking at, but there's every reason to believe that those work. The challenge is just implementing all of those lifestyle interventions. But you all are here, so I will say that you're already doing one of them, because that's social engagement, and that's terrific. Now, you know, you might want to get up at like 1 o'clock and do jumping jacks for 30 minutes so you get your exercise part. Hopefully the diet that you're eating here looks pretty good. But when you go home, and we can talk a little bit about the diet that seems to work or be effective. So there are some things that we can do before that medication, whatever it is, comes down the pike.
Please talk about the diet a little bit. Okay. And that gets right in your wheelhouse too, I bet.
Yeah, it is a little bit in my wheelhouse. So the diets that seem to be very effective, and I will say they're effective for cardiovascular disease, for cancer. So if we made a list of the top issues for Americans, these diets are the sweet spot for all of them. So the first one is the Mediterranean diet, and I think everyone's heard of it. probably most of us don't really follow it, but we've all heard of it. And so the Mediterranean diet is the typical kind of diet that that is eaten in the Mediterranean basin. So as you can imagine, it uses olive oil, doesn't use butter, tends to have a lot of fish, not very much red meat, some poultry, lots of fruits and vegetables. So the core of the diet is fruits and vegetables and whole grains with small amounts of protein in the form of fish and poultry, not much dairy, and then lots of seeds and nuts and beans. So that's the typical Mediterranean diet, and that absolutely is beneficial in all of those diseases that we're talking about. So then there's another diet that was developed specifically for hypertension called the DASH diet. Has anybody been put on the DASH diet here? Anybody? No? Yeah, one person. So we have it. Huh? Ah, okay, great. Well, so I'm a little disappointed knowing that there probably is a little more hypertension than that the DASH diet is not more generally talked about. But so the DASH diet is similar to the Mediterranean diet with a few modifications. So those are really good base diets. So there was a group out of University of Chicago that looked at diet as a way to treat dementia. And so they combined the Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet, and that's called the MIND diet. And I can't tell you what MIND stands for, but it's like Mediterranean, and the D is probably DASH. I don't know. But anyway, you know, we love all these acronyms that no one can remember. So the MIND diet is a combination of the two. I just have to be clear with everyone. We're using the term diet as a description of the kind of foods that are being eaten, not that it suggests that if you do this, you're going to lose weight. So you can remain whatever weight you are and be on any of these diets. You could be on the Mediterranean diet, the DASH diet, the MIND diet. It's not a weight loss diet. It's a health diet. It's a health plan, I guess is the best way to say it. So the MIND diet almost completely eliminates red meat. So that just, you're not going to the rodeo with this one. That's all I can tell you. and so the red meat goes out the window. It's very much a plant-based diet. Cheese almost completely disappears. I want to say it's like an ounce of cheese a week. No, seriously, it's like, you know, you look at the cheese stick that you give your grandkids, and it's like, yeah, I wish I could eat that this week, but I can't. No butter. So there's some no's, but there basically are two categories of foods. There's yes foods and no foods, and the yes foods are nuts. So there's a lot of nuts that are added into the diet. Beans are, I think, 3 or 4 times a week. You're adding beans to things. Here's a good part of it is 4 ounces of red wine a day. It sounds like that's great until you pour your first 4 ounce and you're like, really?
That's 4 ounces.
Come on. That's the preview to the bottle. I'm just testing to make sure the wine's good before I serve it. But anyway, 4 ounces of red wine a day. So there are a lot of foods that are basically you can eat as much as you want. Red wine, but only 4 ounces. No, 4 ounces.
Sorry, Vince.
4 ounces. Otherwise, you're off the farm. You're on your own at that point. And then the other hard part about the MIND diet is that, and this is actually true for most diets that look at cancer, heart disease, stroke, as well as now with Alzheimer's, sugar is a big problem. And so sweets are off the table. So fried foods and sweets are out. So I will just tell you that I'm not a strong adherent to the MIND diet because I like a few more sweets than what the MIND diet allows. But anyway, so it's a pretty easy diet to understand I'll say it that way, to understand. To follow, it's a little more challenging, but honestly, that's true about lifestyle. Making any lifestyle change is really hard. And so generally, you make lifestyle changes in small doses. So you decide, okay, I'm going to start incorporating beans into my diet. Most people, most Americans don't actually regularly include beans. So you say, how could I add some beans to my weekly intake? So I can tell you that I did. I say, okay, whenever I make pasta, I throw in a can of beans into the pasta with whatever the sauce is. Nobody notices the difference, and I've included some beans in my diet. When I make a salad, I always put nuts in. So where I used to not do that, now there's always either walnuts or pecans in the salad. Oh, and some dried cherries because I want to get some bright red fruits in. So there are ways you can incorporate some of them, some of those changes, and some of them you say, you know what? I'm not willing to change my lifestyle that much. I'm still having a piece of cherry pie. I'm still going to the rodeo, so...
Yeah, but that's life, right?
That's right.
Tensions and,
that's right.
And decisions and what's quality of life versus, you know, health.
Exactly.
And we make those all the time.
Exactly.
Any other question? Well, as you think of a question, I'm going to go to Beth, but just real briefly, maybe talk a bit about that social engagement piece and how important that is to avoid isolation and get that stimulation from each other. And then we'll go to Beth.
Okay. So, social engagement, of course... One thing that I think everyone knew this before, but we all just lived through a few years of COVID and found ourselves very isolated. And what we saw among people with dementia or with Alzheimer's is that it was even more difficult for people with cognitive impairment to be that isolated. So they gave us a good understanding of just the impact on everyone, that how much impact it has on our cognitive function. And, you know, the thing about, it's actually the hardest thing to do is to be around other people, because you have to be monitoring everyone. Like, oh my gosh, I have to pay attention to, are people listening to me? Do they think I'm an idiot? You know, I'm having to look at everyone. So when you're around a group of people, you're trying to keep up with all the conversations and try to make intelligent comments occasionally, make sure that people know you're listening. This is not an easy thing to do. It's easier to do a puzzle at home, but a puzzle at home is really not as cognitively stimulating as being around other people. And we know that support of having other people who know you, care about you. I mean, you know, it was so interesting to me listening to talking about the people who you all know and love and that you're going to pray for, because they're people that they're the empty chair in the room. And that empty chair, my goodness, the most impactful thing that we can do is to call them and let them know, hey, I missed you. You were at the empty chair, because that's the way we feel like we're valued. And that's very cognitively stimulating. So being present is important, but also connecting to other people is very important.
Mm, it's great. Beth?
My sister has Lewy body dementia, and I noticed Bill McDonald on our list is Lewy body. Are there advances being made in that area like there are in Alzheimer's?
We see that diagnosis a lot more recently, I think.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
So the Alzheimer's Association, which is the largest non-governmental funder of Alzheimer's research in the world, we don't just fund Alzheimer's. So we fund basically anything that's related to cognitive impairment in the brain. So we're interested in what those processes look like, the differences as well as the similarities. So, you know, the challenge is before you can treat something, you have to understand what causes it. And the brain is the most complex organ, and we still don't fully understand how it works. And so all of them, I mean, we don't fully understand how Alzheimer's disease progresses. That's the disease we've been talking about for the longest. But remember, Alzheimer's disease was only identified in 1906, so it's not like we've had a long time to be thinking about it. It's a relatively shorter amount of time. And then the Alzheimer's Association has only been around since the early 80s. So, you know, unlike, you can say, well, cancer is way advanced and heart, you know, heart is way advanced. Well, American Heart Association celebrated a 100-year anniversary, and cancer almost the same. So we're new on the block, and we're dealing with the most complex organ, and we're trying to understand what do these disease processes look like? How are they similar, as well as how are they different? The two compounds in almost every one of the disease processes, you'll hear about two compounds, and one is amyloid, the one that I mentioned that this new drug clears in the brain, and the other is tau. And so some diseases are more tau diseases, and some diseases are more amyloid diseases, and Alzheimer's has the fortune of being both an amyloid and a tau disease.
And that's tangles and plaques often.
Correct.
Is called.
Correct. And the other thing about these diseases is it depends where the disease starts in the brain. So, you know, for example, a lot of people talk about at some point in the disease process, you can't tell the difference between someone who has Parkinson's and someone who has Alzheimer's. And the reason is that Parkinson's starts in the movement part of the brain, so that's why the first thing you see with someone who has Parkinson's is movement changes. But as it spreads through the brain, it starts affecting other brain functions, which include memory and reasoning. So it starts in a movement part, but spreads to other areas. Alzheimer's starts in the memory part, but it spreads also. So when it spreads, eventually it will affect the movement part. So, you know, in trying to understand what's happening with a family member, if you go to a neurologist, for example, the most important thing they do is a history and physical. And the reason for a history is to try and understand what was the first manifestation you saw and what did it look like? So with, you know, did they have judgment changes first? Did they start hearing voices? Or, you know, those things will tell them probably what the disease, what it started as to understand. But, I mean, we're not anywhere with any of these diseases where we're ready to declare victory.
Yeah. Let me ask you one thing before we go to Sue and then Daniel. Is maybe something that we can do to help as far as, you know, whether it's support the Alzheimer's Association or other organizations. I mean, I know there's government research, but what else can we do practically?
Yeah, so I love that practical question. That's great. So there are a lot of things that we can do. And so one is the more people who hear about the resources that are available, those are fewer people who are going to find themselves alone, isolated, thinking that they're the only ones, dealing with the stigma and the fear that no one wants to be around them. So you all are probably members of other groups. This is perhaps not the only group, and we're happy to send out someone to provide an education program for any group you have. So whether it's, you know, the group where you live, your civic association, if you're members of, you know, some other kind of group, please invite us and we're happy to come. We also are always looking for volunteers. So if you're interested, if you have a little extra time and you would like to volunteer, we would love to engage you in volunteer activities. On an individual level, if you'd be open to participating in clinical trials, we're always looking for people for clinical trials. The only way that we will really understand this disease is to not only have people who are living with Alzheimer's or dementia, but also people who are not, so that we can see the difference between a healthy person's brain and a person who has a disease process in their brain. So there's lots of opportunity for all kinds of studies, and you can go to Trial Match is the name of our... we have an online dating service for clinical trials, and so you can sign up for that. I can tell you that you're not committing to anything, so you can sign up, and we will We will contact you whenever you match a different trial, and you can say, oh, that sounds really interesting. And some of them are just taking a survey, and some of them may be participating in some kind of a lifestyle change, and then some of them are you're actually taking a drug or just giving blood once a month. There are all kinds of different trials, and some of them you may choose to do, and some of them you may choose not to do. And I can tell you that there are a few I've said, no, I am not doing that. And so I just flip the page. It's like, yeah, just flip left and keep going. So anyway, so participating in trial match is certainly one. And then, I mean, you know, we're not the only organization dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia in the city. There are lots of them. And so we would love for you to participate in things that we do. We have a walk in the fall. In fact, I mean, as a congregation, you could decide to get together and come to our walk. It's a good social engagement, exercise, you know, lots of things all at the same time. And our walk is the largest awareness raising and fundraising event about Alzheimer's and dementia in the United States. And Houston is one of the top 15 in the country. So we'd love for you to come and do that. But I will tell you that there are many other wonderful organizations that you could help with, and those families would very much appreciate the support.
It was fun. I did this year. We have 4 or 5 minutes, Daniel, and then Sue. Maybe a repeat. And there's a lot of different ways the research could go. I know there's even disputes around we should do this, more money should go this way versus more money should go this way. And that's always the case in the medical field, I think. But yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's good. Sue. Talk to us a little bit, and I'll just repeat the question. Talk for the people online too. Talk to us a little bit about concussion and head trauma.
Yeah. So just so you know, I never stuck my finger in a wall socket, and I'm terrible with names, so I'm not sure what my reason is, but it's probably we share the same problem. So, you know, all of us have areas that we're good at and areas that we're not so good at. And so if you're consistently good at some things and terrible at other things, then I think as we age, we start to focus on the things we're not good at and think, oh my goodness, does that mean that I have Alzheimer's? No, it means that you've always sucked at it, and so you still do. And so, you know, there you go. So the risks for developing dementia, one of them is a concussion. So losing consciousness as a result of some kind of head injury is associated with an increased risk of dementia. And of course, multiple experiences increases the risk more. I will just tell you, if you've lived to be 65, getting to 65 is a bigger risk by itself than having a concussion when you were 15. So you probably have moved on to some other bigger risks than that.
And two more questions that we're gonna roll up, but I guess if you have time to stick around a little bit,
sure.
Gail, and then Andy.
Is there a clinical reason why one person with Alzheimer's has got
this pleasant personality, even though they don't, might not recognize you, and there's another person that is as unpleasant to be around you? Any reason, again, I'll repeat it, any reason for sort of, behavioral manifestations of, with the same diagnosis, but... the manifestations are different in terms of behavior.
Yeah, so there are a lot of thoughts on that. You know, here we are. We're back to that same question of we don't fully understand how the brain functions, and we don't fully understand how Alzheimer's disease or some other form of dementia affects the brain. So we have those two things going against us to begin with. There are a few things that happen with any form of dementia. You start to see people's filters fray, and so since we don't know what was in any other person's brain, the way they perceived the world, and what kind of filters they needed to be able to be successful or effective, we don't know which filters are fraying, I guess is the best way to say it. So, I mean, you know, before dementia, if we just think about all the people we know, some of them are not very nice people, or at least not very nice to us. So we know people who are really nice to some people and really not nice to other people, which means that they must be using a filter for some people and maybe not for others. And so maybe with dementia, which was their natural state? Generally not nice, with good filters for the people they wanted to influence. You know, so since we don't know that, we all want to think the best of especially our family. We want to think the best of them. So if they become nasty as they develop dementia, it's got to be, the dementia must be bringing out these horrible attributes. Well, maybe they were just kind of, that they just had nice filters for us that frayed. We don't know. But it's a challenge that we don't know the answer to at this point. I can tell you, my aunt, going back to... So my aunt was generally not a very nice person. I mean, most people who knew her thought she was a difficult, not very nice person. I had the most delightful experience with her. My 10 years of being her caregiver were joyous. So I don't know if that's, you know, for some reason, maybe her filter, she thought she needed to be nasty to be able to be successful. And, or, I mean, who knows? But I have also had the other experience, I'll just say that.
So. It's hard, but I think it's a response that we can do is just to give grace as much as we can.
Absolutely.
And say, you know, this is the disease that's
right
working its way, ravaging this person's personality. Sometimes maybe even if it's not, you know, to have that grace for people, but that's a hard question.
One other thing, though, if a person is generally even and then you experience that there's really a more of a sudden change, that they become more aggressive or disruptive. So most of the geriatric psychiatrists would say that that's an indication of physical discomfort and pain. So they would say that this is a time to really be looking for is there a physical reason that they don't have the full ability to communicate. And so you're getting a physical and emotional manifestation of some kind of discomfort. And so you should be looking, you know, do they have a tooth infection, a bladder infection? You know, there's something physical going on if it's truly a notable change in a relatively shorter period of time.
And we are over. You're still on page one of your presentation here, but it's been like riveting. So I just thank you for being here. But Andy, ask your question, please.
Yeah, I'm not completely sure exactly how to phrase this question, but the subject is care and assistance to caregivers.
Hmm. Good. Yeah. Just talk a little bit about how caregivers can be cared for a little bit.
Yeah, that is so important as a caregiver to find time to provide care for yourself. So you know, in the same way that when you get on an airplane, the first thing they tell you is that, you know, that if the oxygen mask drops down, you put it on yourself first and then on your children or whatever else, because in order to be effective, you first have to make sure you've got oxygen. And that's true for caregivers, for any kind of caregiver, for Alzheimer's or anything else. So there are a number of ways you can do that. One is to attend a support group. So there are support groups all over the city. We run support groups. We partner with organizations that run support groups. So I would encourage anyone who's a caregiver to find a caregiver support group. I know some people don't find that comfortable. And so if that's not an option, then another, and by the way, there are also online support groups. So if going in person is difficult or uncomfortable, consider doing one online. There are also, sometimes it's good to take your loved one and let them go somewhere else and get a break from you. I mean, I don't mean to be rude, but sometimes they need a break from you as much as you need a break from them, and they get a different kind of stimulation. And so there are lots of different programs that provide a respite for the caregiver and provide a stimulating environment for the person with dementia. Two organizations that in our area that offer those kinds of programs. One is Amazing Place, which I believe this congregation is participating with. And so Amazing Place is a good adult day program that you can use as many days or as few days in a week or month as you'd like. And it's a full day of structured activities and a good break for a caregiver. Another organization is Care Partners, and they operate respite programs out of congregations throughout the city. So I don't know. Do you all have a?
No.
I know there are a couple down in the museum district at congregations. So those are generally congregations will provide those one or two times a month, and they're usually 4 to 6 hour programs. So you would leave your loved one there for that amount of time and go, you know, just go walk through the museum or go grocery shopping or, you know, get your hair cut or get a massage or go out to lunch with a friend. So those are good options as a way to get a break from being a caregiver.
Well, Richard, thank you for being here. I mean, just so great and just great information. Can you stay for a second
sure.
if people have additional questions that they might want to ask you? But thank you for being here. Thank you for the work that you're doing. And we will find ways to support Alzheimer's Association and the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks so much.